It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's Sally Swift, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper. Just when we think we know all the techniques we need in the kitchen, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt turns up.
Traditional blanching is when you'll take a green vegetable and drop it in boiling water, not till it's fully cooked, but till it's almost cooked. And from there, you can chill it, and it's ready to go. Cryoblanching, take those same vegetables, put them in a single layer, and then freeze them. And freezing, what it does is it'll crystallize the water molecules inside the vegetables, and those crystals have sort of sharp, jagged edges that end up puncturing and breaking cells, the same way that boiling a vegetable will. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't alter the flavor. So you end up with a vegetable that's essentially blanched, but it still has a very fresh, green flavor.
Better Cooking with the Food Lab and memoirist Mary Carr on carnality and writing. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Sally Swift, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper. When J. Kenji Lopez-Alt was in the fourth grade, he was given an assignment to write a book about himself. What would he become? His answer, married at 24, kids at 26, PhD at 29, and find the cure for cancer, and then be awarded the Nobel Prize. He would then leave science and spend the next 40 years as the president of Legoland. Well, there was a small change of plans, because that kid grew up to be intensely curious about the hows and whys of food. J. Kenji is the managing culinary director of SeriousEats.com and author of their award-winning column, The Food Lab. Lynn sat down with him to talk about his masterful new book, inspired by that column, The Food Lab, Better Cooking Through Science.
Kenji, it's great to have you with us.
It's so good to be on.
You know, I have to say, I usually don't rave about a book, but I have to say that if anybody cooks even once a month, this book would probably be a revelation to them. And I think a lot of it is not only I have no idea how you came to these conclusions. You had to have been working 24 hours a day for God knows how long, but also you make it so readable. Because often when you get into food science, you know, your eyes roll back.
Right.
I mean, I gather this is purposeful.
It is. You know, I grew up watching kids' science shows. You know, I loved science as a kid. I loved science classes. And so I think the best teachers are the ones that make the science interesting and make it sound like, you know, something just really cool, which is what it is.
Yeah. How do you work? Because you do exhaustive tests to come to conclusions that often go against everything we've ever been told. I mean, how do you work? How do you go through the process?
I work mostly from the hours of midnight to 4 a.m. in my underwear. And
That's a nice detail. I like that.
that's where the writing takes place.
But the
cooking work, you know, it starts off with a ton of research. You know, if I'm going to start working on a given recipe or even if I'm just thinking about a technique, it starts with research. So it starts with looking up all the classic techniques, looking in cookbooks, looking online, looking at other, you know, really innovative, smart cooks that I know and seeing what they've done with it. So it all starts with a lot of research. And then from there, I start to design a sort of set of experiments that I'm planning on carrying out. You know, but really just keeping in mind the end goal is to make food better, more efficient, always with the constraint that these are recipes designed for normal everyday people who are not going to be buying really fancy equipment or going to specialty markets to find, you know, exotic ingredients. And then from there, you know, you just poke and prod and experiment until you discover either that everybody's been doing it right the whole time or that, you know, maybe there are ways you can improve it. And often you find that there are ways you can improve techniques or recipes.
Let's talk about some of these, okay? For instance, your idea about cooking meat, you know, things that you would do in a skillet or on a grill.
Right. So traditional recipes will have you start fast and finish slow.
Right.
And I think that sort of stemmed from the idea that searing meat will sort of lock in juices. You know, how the idea is that you create this sort of cauterized crust on the outside and that prevents juices on the inside from escaping.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and it turns out that this has been proven to be untrue many, many times. It's actually very simple to prove it yourself. You know, you can sear one side of a steak, get a really nice brown crust, flip it over and let it cook. And eventually you'll start to see juices bubbling out of that seared surface. So, you know, quite obviously it's not actually sealed. You know, the other way you can test it is by searing meat first and finishing it slow, and then doing the opposite, which is starting slow and searing at the end. And, you know, by doing this, what you find is that actually the meat that you sear, the one that you sear at the end, loses far less juices than the one that you sear at the beginning. And so that is a technique that I recommend for many things, you know, steaks, pork chops, hamburgers. I recommend it for, you know, if you're going to roast a whole chicken. It basically, like any sort of fast cooking meat that you want to get a nice brown crust on. Starting it low and slow until it's very close to the final temperature that you're going to serve it. So, you know, for a steak, that would be, you know, you bring it up to around 110 degrees or so, and then you sear it at the very end. And by the time it's done searing, it's at around 125, which is like a nice medium rare. And, you know, the difference is that you get a very even cook from edge to edge. It's nice and pink all the way throughout, as opposed to a more traditional steak, which has a kind of temperature gradient where it's gray on the outside and transitions to pink in the middle.
Okay, micro-steaming. Tell us about micro-steaming.
Well, micro-steaming, I mean, it's just a portmanteau. It's microwaving and steaming. You know, people are afraid of the microwave. And, you know, even the other day I was on Twitter and somebody mentioned, oh, you know, this restaurant must microwave all their food. And they were talking about one of these sort of, you know, big national chain restaurants. And, you know, and to me that was just like, well, you know what? Like, I've worked in restaurants like that, and most of those places don't microwave their food. But you know where they do microwave food a lot is actually at very fancy restaurants. And I think it's... you know, I think it's because a lot of at these fancy restaurants, chefs maybe use a little bit more, you know, use a little bit more thought and realize, you know what, the microwave is just another tool. There's nothing evil about it. Just because most of the things people cook in it happen to be frozen dinners, it doesn't mean that it can't be used as a good tool for cooking real fresh food. So micro steaming is essentially you steam green vegetables. You can do green beans, you can do asparagus, you can do whole ears of corn, things like that. You know, you put it on a plate with a little bit of water, cover it, and microwave it, and it steams much faster than it would on the stovetop, and you actually end up preserving a lot more color and a lot more flavor. You know, I'm not a nutritionist, but I'm told you also preserve more nutrients that way.
And you save the pot of water and all of that.
Yes.
Cryoblanching.
Yeah. Well, cryoblanching is a thing that my friends over at Ideas in Food, it's a food blog that's been around since, I think, before food blogs even existed. They came up with this concept called cryoblanching. And essentially, you know, traditional blanching is when you'll take a green vegetable and drop it in boiling water, not till it's fully cooked, but until it's almost cooked, just enough that you sort of break down the cell structure. And from there, you can chill it and it's ready to go, you know, for dinner. Then all you have to do is quickly saute it. Cryoblanching is essentially you take those same vegetables, put them in a single layer, and then freeze them. And freezing, what it does is it'll crystallize the water molecules inside the vegetables. And those crystals have sort of sharp, jagged edges that end up puncturing and breaking cells the same way that boiling a vegetable will. So, what it doesn't do is it doesn't alter the flavor. So you end up with a vegetable that's essentially blanched because its cell structure has been broken down a little bit, but it still has a very fresh green flavor. So you freeze your green beans in a single layer, and then when you're ready for dinner, pull them out, let them thaw, and then you just, you know, finish them in a pan with a little bit of butter, and they'll come out tender, perfectly cooked, but with a brighter, fresher green bean flavor than they would if you blanched them in water. And in addition to the green beans, you can actually also do this with other green vegetables like asparagus, fresh peas, snow peas, snap peas, you know, any sort of small green vegetable that's going to freeze quickly.
And then you could actually keep those, right? I mean, if you put them in a container, a sealed
container. You can then transfer them to a freezer bag. And, you know, if you want to do it even better, you can use one of those vacuum sealer bags. Just seal the fresh vegetables in a vacuum sealer bag in a single layer and then throw that straight into the freezer. And that way, when you thaw them out, you can actually thaw them underwater and you don't risk waterlogging them.
Fascinating. Kenji, thank you so much. And good luck with the book.
Thank you. It's so nice to be on.
J. Kenji Lopez-Alt is author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. You can find his recipe for butter-basted, pan-seared, thick-cut steaks, as well as his guide to pan-searing steaks, at splendidtable.org. When I think of driving across the open plain at 70 miles an hour with the windows down, one duo comes to mind. Jane and Michael Stern, documentarians of American road food since the 1970s. They record their eating adventures at roadfood.com and check in with Lynn here on a regular basis.
Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So what's the latest?
Well, we've been traveling around the Southwest in Arizona. I don't know if you remember, I grew up in Tucson. And we were in Bisbee. You know, Tucson is sort of this mega metropolis now. Mm-hmm. But Bisbee is still this really cool, funky, strange little town. And one of the things that's great about Bisbee is even though it's a very strange little funky town, it has tremendously high food consciousness. So it has some great food and great coffee there.
Well, there's a lot of really interesting retro, hip, cutting-edge culture there. I remember the last time we spoke with you about Bisbee, Lynn, was to talk about the Shady Dell Motor Coach Motel, which is a motel that is all Airstream trailers.
I remember this. Yes.
Well, this time we did not stay in an Airstream trailer. We stayed in the old vintage downtown hotel there, which is cool in its own right. But we also found a restaurant there that was it's a great stop for breakfast, lunch, dinner, coffee in between, or a late night snack. It's one of those kind of restaurant markets that has something for everyone.
What is it called?
It's called the High Desert Market and Cafe. We were there every morning at 7 a.m. when they opened because, you know, we were still on Eastern time. Mm-hmm. We had coffee. They have these, you know, wonderful baked goods, scones, muffins, cinnamon rolls. We'd go there for lunch and have, you know, pizza, pasta, sandwiches, dinners. They had, like, beautiful pieces of fish. And between times, you can shop for local crafts, crafts from Africa, soaps, jewelry,
oilcloth, tablecloths from Mexico. I mean, all the chazara, as my grandmother would have said, that a person could want. And it's a great little cafe because it's a cafe, bakery, coffee house, juice bar, grocery, wine shop, crafts gallery, cosmetics emporium, and town gathering spot. So it lacks for nothing.
What I always went back for several times while we were there is the double espresso smoothie, which is made with chocolate syrup, espresso, a fresh banana, milk, and ice cream. This was, I mean, this was my lifeblood for 4 days while we were in Bisbee.
Oh, this sounds so outrageous and so good.
It was really good. Kept me fat and awake. It was terrific.
You know, what's amazing is when I grew up in Arizona, you know, when dinosaurs walked the earth, I mean, there was nothing there. I mean, literally when I grew up there, it was before air conditioning, before TV. I mean, I can't believe I managed to stay alive. But I don't remember any food except for steaks. I mean, I think we had steak. But now...
Oh, there's a wide variety. There was a great Vietnamese restaurant there.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was terrific.
A couple of two really great coffee roasters. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting food that you would never expect in Southern
Arizona.
And
that weird little market, and I don't even remember the name of it, that made its own candied ginger and crystallized ginger. And it was like the best crystallized ginger I ever had in my life.
You two keep saying, though, that this is a strange town. Now, is this strange, the fact that all of these things come together in this one place?
Well, that makes it strange. Its history is kind of interesting. You know, it began as a mining town, and there's still evidence of these, like, huge, giant, horrible gashes in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the mining died, it then became a destination for hippies, real counterculture types, and there's still a lot of that there, but it has since kind of become a little bit more valuable real estate and a good place to retire. So you have kind of upscale surge as well. So you have all these different elements. You have the old kind of desert rats who are still there, the hippies who are...
And the alternative lifestyle.
And the alternative lifestyle, and then people with money. So it's a really interesting mix of people.
This sounds like really, I mean, fun.
It is fun.
It's terrific.
Okay, so it's the, let me remind me now, the High Desert.
High Desert Market on Tombstone Canyon in Bisbee, Arizona.
Okay.
Isn't that a great address? 203 Tombstone Canyon.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael's picks at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to enter our 20th anniversary celebration giveaway. We're welcoming in our 20th year with a live event at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thursday, October 22nd, we'll be joined by Argentine grillmaster Francis Malman, New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, and Mexican star chef Enrique Olvera. One lucky winner will get tickets for two, airfare, hotel, and VIP passes. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, award-winning memoirist Mary Carr and rocker Sammy Hagar. Forget the recording studio. He's at work in the kitchen. Lynn's away this week. I'm Sally Swift. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper. Carr is the author of three riveting memoirs, The Liars Club, Cherry, and Lit. Her latest book, The Art of Memoir, is a look at the inspirations and observations behind a good memoir. Contributor David Lee was especially taken by one chapter titled Sacred Carnality and its surprising connection to food.
Mary, welcome to the show.
David, I'm so glad to be here.
And congratulations on the book. It's terrific. It's as much a memoir as it is a masterclass on memoir.
Oh, that's so nice. You know what I've been telling people is I hope it helps make everybody a better reader, not just of memoirs and not just of books, but of their own memories, their own lives, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it will do that. And there's one chapter in the book, I think, that it exploded for me. And I think it will for a lot of our listeners, too. And it's called Sacred Carnality. Now, talk to us about what sacred carnality means.
Well, carne is from meat, obviously, in Latin. So we are such sacks of meat.
Yes.
And those of us who like an animal or two on the plate, are also carnivores. But no, I mean, people assume carnal. When I say the writing should be carnal, they assume it means it should be about, you know.
Right, and but, sex. And
sex and drugs and rock and roll. But no, I mean that you should physically occupy your body and your memories. That's always been the nature of my memory, is very physical or very bodily.
And very sensate, all the senses.
Yeah, like what you can smell and touch and taste. And for me, smell and taste are especially powerful emotionally. So, and then I had a friend who's a neurologist say that it's the oldest sense, that the primary sense
is smell.
Is smell.
Yes. Yeah.
That you animals, you know, can smell changes in territory. But like even one-celled amoeba who have no brain stems can smell. And so much feeling attached to it, right?
Which applies so much to food and in the food writing. What does carnality, sacred carnality, do for the reader when you put it down on the page well?
Well, I think that a memoirist or any writer, really, as I say at the in the preface, you know, this – a lot of what I say about memoir applies to writing fiction or poetry or parole board pleas or marriage proposals. So I think the writer's body should act as an avatar for the reader, that the reader kind of gets zipped into the writer's skin.
That's
in a
great
way.
Line from the book. Yes.
Well, Nabokov has a great line, even better line, of course, because he's Nabokov, which is, you know, that the skull is a space traveler's helmet. So, you know, sort of, it is, right? Our memories take us out of time, and especially in regard to smell and taste and food.
In the beginning of the book, you talk about how smelling, I believe it was curry, can just zoom you back to a childhood memory.
Well, it's like, I think I say something like, you know, you're a grown woman, and then you get a whiff of your dad's curry, and suddenly the whole door to the past
blows right open.
Have you ever just walked into some place that smelled like your mother's house?
Yes. Yes.
And it's how astonished you are by how viscerally, like in your belly and all over your body, that you react to that.
So. Well, it happened to me when my husband was making a cake. The very first time he made a cake, he said, "You want to lick the bowl?" And I was thin and beautiful and young back then. And I thought, well, maybe I will. And I licked it and I zoomed back to my grandmother baking. I mean, suddenly this whole part of my grandmother became very alive, very carnate.
It's very alive, and you're like, all of a sudden you're in it, right? You're living that. And we all have those experiences.
So here you are, a woman, you're sitting at your desk, at your computer, and suddenly you want to write about your sister making squirrel gumbo. How do you wriggle back through that wormhole in time to be able to remember those moments, those senses, those smells, those tastes, to be able to get them onto the page so we can be zipped into your body?
That's how I remember. That's just the nature. But I mean, memory is many things, right? It ricochets around like a pinball. I mean, it's language and it's image and it's story and it's scene and it's sense impressions. I think I have a lot of physical sense impressions. I mean, I probably would have been like a massage therapist or something if I hadn't been a writer. I'm just a body person. It's just how I am.
Very somatic. So now, speaking of squirrel gumbo.
Yes,
As you do frequently. Would you please read that section from The Liars Club about your sister making squirrel gumbo?
My sister had a recipe for a black and garlicky roux that a Cajun neighbor lady had taught her. One whiff of that gumbo will make some gland draw up in the back of your throat and ache. Yankee gumbos are full of tomatoes and okra and all manner of pussyfied spices. But that game gumbo my sister fixed, made with squirrel or duck or deer sausage, came together out of nothing quite so pretty. Instead, it was mixed up from things you cannot live without, lard and flour and onion. It was a thin, black, elemental soup that opened your sinuses from three kinds of pepper and left you tasting garlic and sassafras root for days after. Grandma said just the smell of the roux browning made her want to hork. She took Mother out for shrimp remoulade at Al's Seafood. Shrimp remoulade, I might explain here, was my grandma's moral antidote to all those little split-up squirrel carcasses dismantled and frying in fat. The shrimp are blanched pink, peeled and deveined, then hooked over the side of a Sunday dish like the legs of so many young girls hanging over the edge of a swimming pool. The Sunday dish may get piled up with shredded lettuce in the middle just for show. The remoulade sauce is an extra lemony kind of mayonnaise that has the muted luster of good pearls.
That is wonderful. Mary, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for sharing some of your thoughts on taste and on smell, and congratulations with the book.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Mary Carr is author of The Art of Memoir. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lcecooks.com. That conversation on memoir brought to mind a piece we recorded in the 1990s with Minnesota writer Paul Grucco. Much of his writing was centered around his rural upbringing, the beauty and the struggles, many of which are eerily familiar to the agricultural issues we deal with today. Here's Paul Grucco.
The only acute pain that I can recall suffering because of my family's poverty was the intense humiliation I felt when I discovered, as an adolescent, that most people lived another way, and that there was something shameful, so far as others were concerned, about the way we lived. I was embarrassed to invite my friends to our house, which I had thought cozy and warm, until I was made to see it is dirty and bare. Bread was the issue over which we children voiced our newfound shame. Ours was home-baked, using wheat raised and ground on the farm, leavened with home-cultured yeast, and sweetened with honey made by the bees we kept at the bottom of our garden. It was fabulous bread. Almost every year it won my mother a purple ribbon at the Chippewa County Fair. The slicing of the first loaf in a new batch, still steaming, its sweet, nutty aroma filling the kitchen, was one of the sacred rituals of our household. But my sisters and I, driven by the collapse of rural society out of our local school and into the consolidated town school, had tasted the allure of a new world. We had acquired the preference of the age for anything manufactured over anything homemade. We suddenly coveted boughten bread, contrived from flour so denuded of its essence that its only nutrients came from artificial additives. We were no longer content to eat hick bread. Wonder bread builds strong bodies 12 ways, we said, proud of our familiarity with modern advertising slogans. We yammered and complained, I am ashamed to confess, until Mother finally gave up baking bread, and we began to eat, like modern folk, a factory substitute. The real poverty that we then experienced, but did not recognize, characterizes the impoverishment that befell every aspect of rural culture with the industrialization of farming. Not only our palates suffered, not only our bodies, deprived of wholesome bread, but our very souls. Our souls depended, in ways we had not anticipated, upon the sanctity of the labors that brought bread to our table. We lost the ceremony and artfulness in which every member of the family had some vital role that once attended the eating of the grain, the planting and tilling, the harvesting and winnowing, the grinding and mixing, the miracle of its rising, the mystery of the transforming fire, the sacrament of the first loaf. Making bread was a critical element in the purpose of our lives, and one of the ways by which we were literally joined to the land. It was at the center of our culture, a civilizing force. The wholesome mystery of bread, the sacrament of it, I know now, was never in the ingredients, but in the labor and in the laborers who transfigured them into bread.
That was Paul Grucco reading from his book, Grassroots, The Universe of Home. Now, if that piece doesn't send you scrambling into your kitchen to bake some bread, we've got more ammo for you here. We're posting your all-time favorite recipe. It's for 5-minute artisan bread. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. Sammy Hagar is a bona fide rock star, the Grammy-winning, multi-platinum-selling rock and roll Hall of Fame variety rock star. His backstory is a tale of determination that follows his rise from humble beginnings to success with the bands Montrose, Van Halen, and as a solo artist. And it does not stop there. He's chronicled his love for food, cooking, spirits, and music into a book. He's the author of Are We Having Any Fun Yet? The Cooking and Partying Handbook. And our technical director, Jenny Lupke, jumped at the chance to talk to him.
Sammy Hagar, it is so fun to have you. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, are you kidding me? I'm really honored to and happy to be here talking to you about food.
Well, you know, I bet there's still some of your biggest fans who have no idea that you are a legit cook. I mean, you've even said that you cooked before you rocked. So where did this love of food and cooking begin?
Well, the first chapter in the book is called It All Started in My Grandpa's Trailer, and my grandpa was a great chef. He was an actual chef, but he was an immigrant that came over from Italy when he was about 11 years old, landed in New York, didn't speak the language, went to work in restaurants. So by the time I was born, which I was the youngest of four kids, my grandpa was settled in his trailer, and you would go in his trailer, and it smelled so damn good, and he would feed us the greatest food. It would be like, oh, man, this is so good. So when I was little, I tasted great food, and we never went to restaurants. Don't get me wrong. My parents, I never went to a restaurant until I was in my 20s, and I'm not joking. And he just, you know, you get used to that kind of cooking, and then you know the difference. And so then I go out on the road for 5 or 6 years, really broke, eating the worst food possible. Then when I came back home after that and went back to my mom's house, who was a great cook as well, and back to grandpa's house, and he'd come over and cook on Sunday, I realized how good that food really was, and that's when my mind opened up, and that was probably in my early 20s. And, you know, I got to say, the reason I wanted to write this cookbook, you know, is I'm really interested in doing things that I have a passion for, like, you know, making tequila and now making rum and having restaurants and writing music. I have a passion for that, so I want to do it. Well, I have a passion for food, and I thought, if I'm going to write another book, I want to write about food.
And you organized the book around the three places that you spend the most time. Why did you do it that way?
Well, I you know, it's so funny. These ideas just come to me in the middle of the night. I'm tortured with ideas in the middle of the night. They never come to me when I'm working, you know. They always come to me when I'm trying to sleep. So I thought, I spend so much time in Mexico and then so much time in Hawaii. So in Mexico, it's just a stripped down version of my rock and roll life. You know, I'll come off a tour, like when I was in Van Halen, I'd come home from tour and I'd just go straight down to Mexico to Cabo. And you kind of unplug, but you don't really. I'm going to the canteen at night, you know, rocking out, doing shots of tequila, eating tacos in the street, you know, partying all day on the beach. but I'm doing it in a bathing suit instead of rock and roll clothes. So when I went to Hawaii, I realized I really unplugged there. I put on a sarong on my property. I go husk coconuts. I make my own coconut milk, my own, you know, coconut water, ice cubes for my drinks.
Huh.
Man, you pour the rum over that. The little
That's a good idea.
I'm telling you, coconut water, ice cubes. Go ahead and steal it, folks. Go ahead. I got my rum distillery there. I got a beautiful garden, bananas, you know, chickens that lay eggs. And I eat the chickens. I eat the eggs. You know, it's like I really unplugged there. Mm. And then, of course, my hometown where I live around my house, how I live when I'm just doing this, doing that, going to the studio, working like what I'm doing today.
And so, that's the Mill Valley, California section of the book. You spend a lot of time there, too, work there. You have a restaurant there. And in that section of the book, I found your recipe for paella, and I made that a few days ago. And it was kind of a revelation to me because I always thought that paella was this elevated, complicated dish, but it's really not.
I love that dish. And I was asked in an interview recently, if there was a dish that represents me, if I were a dish, what would it be? I said, paella, you know, it's got everything in it and it kind of works all in one bite. So,
and you can throw other things in it too.
Yeah, it's so versatile.
You know, I looked at your instructions and I thought, well, that's just like a seasoned rice dish. I could probably do this. And it was a hit at my house.
You know, when you hit it right, it's great. You can mess it up. You know, you can make it too gooey and not dry enough.
Right.
I like that crunchy thing in the bottom, man.
Yeah, I didn't wait long enough, but next time
I'll So you get in a hurry. You got to leave that towel on there that last 5 or 6 minutes.
I do like your colorful instructions. I'll just leave it at that. You have great instructions for the recipe. And I listened. I did not stir it.
I wrote this cookbook and, you know, I have a co-writer, but I talk through every recipe the way I do it, exactly in my own voice.
Yeah, that makes it fun. You also know a thing or two about wine and spirits. So how about some wine or spirit and food pairings?
Well, as far as the way I cook most of the time in Mexico or Hawaii, wine doesn't pair that well with it. But I'm a wine-paired guy. I mean, I love wine. I have a collection I've been collecting my whole, well, since my mid-20s. So, but in general, you know, I think a good margarita with some really hot food or a good mojito with the rum, which is a little sweeter, not quite so salty. And I think you get a little more flavor out of that with Pacific Rim, things like if you're eating shrimp that are hot or Thai food and things like that. I'm a mojito guy, man. There's nothing better than a mojito to wash some kind of semi-spicy Asian Pacific Rim food down. And that's my Hawaiian thing.
Sounds great.
Now, I'm always experimenting with cocktails. I'll give everybody one big fat, strong lick. And that is, if you're going to use limes, use good fresh limes. Don't just try to go to a substitute. Lemons or limes. You know, you can use orange, but it's sweeter. But just fresh juice. I hate the mixed things.
Okay. And you've included some of your favorite drink recipes in the book and some dishy stories and pictures in it.
So juicy stories, right?
Yeah. But besides that good stuff, I like that you encourage us to improvise.
Yeah, to me, the most fun about cooking is not following a recipe exactly. It's like, use your creativity, because that's the most fun thing about cooking, is making something from nothing. It's just like writing a song. When I write a song, I start with this, a guitar. I pick it up. I think, okay, I'm going to write a song on guitar. It's just like, okay, well, I'm going to make a dish from chicken. You know, it's like, you know, and then just keep moving on. Pretty soon you need a base on there. So you think, oh, I'll put some potatoes in there. So that's the base part. You know, and I need to spice it up. And then, you know, now you're adding something else. It's like, it's the same exact process until you feel like, this is what I like. This is what I want to hear, or this is what I want to eat. It's the same process, and that's the most fun part.
That's great. Well, I'll be cooking more from this book. It's fun to read, and I really liked your autobiography as well. You're kind of a Renaissance man. You've really done a lot of interesting things.
I'm paella.
Paella, man. You're a mixture of all kinds of things, all kinds of good things. Well, Sammy Hagar, this has been fun. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sammy Hagar is author of Are We Having Any Fun Yet? The Cooking and Partying Handbook. He left us with that paella recipe as well as a cocktail, the Maui Mama. Find them at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Lynn takes your calls, and what does the Renaissance have to do with the watermelon we love? I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift, in today for Lynn Rosetto Casper. She's away this week, but is never one to miss out on talking with you, so she came in a bit earlier to field some of your calls.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
We're connecting with you. Get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org.
Julie's on the line from Brooklyn. Hey, Julie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me. I love your show. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I'm calling because I have joined ACSA for the first time. It's been really, really fun, you know, trying to...
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. But so I have been getting at least one or two heads of lettuce every week.
Right.
So I've been having a lot of salads, but I'm trying to figure out what else I can do with lettuce. Yeah, I have a lot of lettuce in my fridge right now.
What kinds of lettuce do you have?
So right now I have romaine and red leaf. And one week I got a head of, I think it was called red oak. It was beautiful.
Oh, God, it's beautiful. And it has a little bit of assertiveness when you bite into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of lively.
It was beautiful, yeah. So that's been great getting all the different lettuces. And I've been having, like, a lot of fun salads, but...
But there's a time when you'd like to eat something that's different with the lettuce. Okay, there's a couple of things you can do. First of all, there's lettuce soup. And this is something that you might want to do with the romaine or the red leaf. And it's really easy. You chop up some garlic with a bit of onion. Take some olive oil. Put it in a, you know, 4-quart saucepan. Saute that until it's really soft.
Okay.
Add broth. It could be vegetable broth. It could be, you know, chicken broth. It could come from a box. But the point is that you want to add, for a medium onion and about 3 or 4 cloves of garlic, you'd probably want about 4 or 5 cups of broth.
Okay.
Simmer that for a little bit. You can throw in whatever fresh herb you like. Tarragon is really lovely with lettuces.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. And then you've chopped up the lettuce, like a head of the lettuce. Mm-hmm. And what you're going to do is just drop it in there and then pull it off the stove, let it cool, puree it, and you can add a little bit of cream. Or or you could serve it cold, which is great, or, you know, lightly chilled. Okay. I like to use whole milk yogurt.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you run across the cream top brown cow yogurt. There's a couple of others. It is like eating solid cream. It is so delicious, and the cultures are alive and whatever. And so you chill down that soup, and then what you do is you just stir in the cream or the yogurt. I think the yogurt has more interest. But and a little bit of new potato could have gone into that broth and, you know, thin sliced and cooked. But the idea is the lettuce taste is bright and fresh and it's very green. So you don't really cook it as much as you just drop it in, get it cooled down, puree it, and you're off and running.
That sounds delicious. I've never heard of lettuce soup before. That
well, you can do awesome. It. And also, if some peas could have gone in to the chicken broth and you cook it for maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
And that will get, that brings you another flavor as well. So it's just gorgeous. And the other thing is whole heads of lettuce, wash them, dry them upside down, get them as dry as you can, but leave them intact. And then what you do is get a nice hot grill going. And
ooh, I like where this is going.
Yeah. What I like to do is I tuck whole leaves of fresh basil between the leaves of the lettuce, and I just lay them on the grill, brush them with a little bit of olive oil and a lot of coarse salt, and grill them. They'll wilt on one side, get a little brown, turn it over, and a little brown. They don't look gorgeous, but boy, do they taste good. You put that out on a platter. You can cut them, you know, and slice them, but with some tomatoes you've cut in wedges and a little bit more olive oil and maybe a dash of lemon.
And I just got basil from the CSA.
There you go. Okay. You're completely taken care of.
Oh, my God.
We have just
so
knocked
good.
Out 2 courses of supper.
Awesome. And that's 2 heads of lettuce. gone and used.
You got it. And really, you could have, you know, at least one head in the soup.
Yeah.
So we've got three we can knock out. Okay. Have a great time with it.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye, Julie. 800-537-5252. That's where we are. And we have Catherine calling from Philadelphia. Catherine, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm trying to figure out whether it's worthwhile to buy a tagine, and they're coming out now with, in the enameled cast iron bottoms, as opposed to just using the enameled cast iron pots that I already have.
Ooh.
And one thing, we, in the last few years, downsized from a house to an apartment. So where to store is a concern or an issue. But also, I like the flavors of the Moroccan food and Northern African food. And I also enjoy making one-dish meals, particularly for entertaining, where my kitchen can stay pretty clean when my guests arrive. Anyway, do you have any thoughts about...
I have several. With the downsizing, you're singing my song. I'm in the midst of that right now, and it's tough. I'm looking at this new kitchen, and I'm saying, where are all those cabinets I had?
Yeah.
Here's the thing about the tagine. It's that shallow, essentially ceramic dish originally with a cone top on it. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the steam rises from the food as it cooks, and the tagine is this wonderful, they're silky stews made with everything you can imagine, and the steam collects on that conical interior and then comes back down on the food. Now, frankly, you don't have to have a tagine. And one of my problems with a tagine is often they're too small.
Mm-hmm.
When I want to do a dish that'll feed six, a tagine is usually, if it's a true Moroccan-style one, you in Morocco, you wouldn't do a meal that is just has a tagine.
Yeah.
You know, you do a meal with many, many things, or at least several dishes. So having a modest amount of it is fine. But our style of eating is often we do one dish like that with accompaniments, but not multiple complicated dishes or very filling dishes. So that's one of my bones of contention with the tagines that are available. And I think I have been doing tagines in a heavy enameled cast iron pot and in other pots as well for a very long time. Now, I haven't gotten to Morocco, but I've eaten some pretty decent Moroccan food in restaurants and in people's homes who are from Morocco, and my tagines aren't too bad. So I think you don't need to get the tagine.
Mm-hmm.
But the other piece of this is this. It's such a cool thing.
Yeah.
And you bring that to the table, and it just looks so good. But if you're going to get a tagine, get two, because then you're going to be able to make the amount that you really want to have. Mm-hmm. So that's my thing about the tagine.
Now, I know, I think it's Staub that puts out a 3-quart brazier. Is that what I say?
Brazier, if you want to be French.
Which,
a brazier, yes, a brazier.
It doesn't have the conical shape, but supposedly has in the lid some little features that...
They have dimples. The dimples help the steam to collect and drop down onto the meat or to whatever's being cooked. That's a lovely idea, but quite frankly, any good heavy pot that you can cook in and you know, not get hot and cold spots with a good sealed lid will serve you well. And the other thing is, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be heavy cast iron. It can be Allclad has a wonderful system where you have aluminum as the heat conductor, which is much lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Thick aluminum, a lining of stainless steel, and sometimes there's an exterior of copper or something else.
Mm-hmm.
But the aluminum going all the way up the sides, because that's the real key. You don't want just a plaque at the bottom. And this is true of any pot you buy.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, you want to have all that heat conductor going up the sides. It's going to be less money more or less. But the most important thing is it's easier to handle.
Yeah.
Because when you get 3 pounds of meat into something that already weighs almost 3 pounds or 4 pounds of meat, it gets to be very heavy.
Well,
so
yes.
I'd say those are very practical solutions to this whole question.
Mm-hmm.
Of a pot de braise.
That's very helpful.
Well, good, Catherine. And you have my mouth watering thinking about it, Tajine.
Okay.
Enjoy the cooking.
I will. Absolutely.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lynn will be back next week. I'm Sally Swift. Remember, we always love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Send us a tweet. Get to us on Facebook. The more, the merrier. Paintings are so much more than just pretty pictures. Take the 17th century still life of a watermelon by Giovanni Stanchi. It looks entirely different than the watermelons we know today. In fact, James Nienhuis, a horticulture professor at the University of Wisconsin, uses the Stanchi painting in his classes to teach about the history of crop breeding. Lynn got the story.
Jim, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
So, Jim, why does a horticultural professor teach students about a 500-year-old melon? I have to say, it's one of the most striking visions I can imagine, a big, round watermelon cut in half. And there's a thick white membrane that divides the melon into 6 pie-shaped wedges. Now, inside each wedge, red flesh curlicues form a heart shape. And between those curlicues are empty gaps with black seeds. What was the evolution? I mean, how quickly did the watermelon become that solid red color?
Really, it deals with the issue of, you know, even the more fundamental questions of why actually a watermelon is red on the inside or mm-hmm. a carrot is orange. Why are they have color at all? Vegetables. And, you know, it could be involved with pollination or attraction of herbivores or, you know, dissuasion of herbivores. But really, the carotenoids, the yellows, the oranges, and the reds are there for light, for photosynthesis. And, I mean, think about this for a moment. If the carotenoids are there for light absorption, I think most carrots grow underground. So why?
Here's the light.
So what the heck are they doing there becoming orange when they can't even see the light? And the watermelon, you know, if I'm not mistaken, it's probably pretty dark inside there.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah.
So why would they become bright red? And the reason for the answer to both of those questions is because we, human beings, we domesticated and selected and bred these crops, and those were the colors that were pleasing to us. And that's why the watermelon became, you know, as you described, those wonderful curlicues on the inside of that placental tissue.
Yeah.
That redness is all about us. You know, I think what we're most fascinated with is simply the fact that the watermelon, you know, what it looked like 500 years ago in Renaissance art. You know, vegetables are perishable. So we don't have the luxury that, you know, that paleontologists have when they look at grains, mm-hmm. you know, in which the grains can be preserved for, you know, centuries in dry climates. So they can look at the evolution of, you know, wheat from a little grain to a larger grain and the colors. Vegetables are perishable. So we don't have any indication of what they looked like 500 years ago because that was prior to, you know, my iPhone or the Kodak yeah. camera. So the only way we can really look at that recent history is through Renaissance art. You not only do you look at the painting, but you also look at the artist, and by their names you can often determine if they're Dutch or, you know, or Italian or Flemish or whatever. But you can also look at the dates, and you can learn a lot about the history of vegetable domestication. And what fascinates me is you'll look at some of these paintings, and you'll see that, you know, within 20 or 30 years after the, you know, discovery of, you know, the Americas, well, or the rediscovery of the Americas, you will find that there are tomatoes pictured in Italy, or you will find squash pictured in Italy, which is remarkable because those crops
are native to
the Americas.
The Americas. And you see them so elegantly painted. One of those Stanchi paintings has a picture of a tomato on it that looks, I mean, it's like 1495, right, is when the painting was made. And it has a tomato in it that looks like a burpy big boy. I said, wow, how? Talk about speed, right? You can tell that the Italians must have just been fascinated with this particular crop. And they domesticated it very rapidly.
Jim, this has been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
James Nienhuis is a horticulture professor at the University of Wisconsin. You can find a recipe for the classic Mexican watermelon agua fresca at splendidtable.org. Lynn will be back next week. I'm Sally Swift. Thanks for joining us. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Enrico Caruso. He said, "Watermelon, it's a good fruit. You eat, you drink, you wash your face." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Be sure to visit splendidtable.org to enter our 20th anniversary celebration giveaway. We're welcoming in our 20th year with a live event at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, on Thursday, October 22nd. We'll be joined by Argentine grillmaster Francis Malman, New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, and Mexican star chef Enrique Olvera. One lucky winner will get tickets for two, airfare, hotel, and VIP passes. That's splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Lynn will be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Sally Swift, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.